information to tell you about, and we're going to be digging into the UFO phenomena here soon with Stanton Friedman on Speaking of Strange. And now, Stanton Friedman is probably the world's top UFO expert. Since 1967, he has lectured on the topic at more than 600 colleges in numerous countries, and was the original civilian investigator of the 1947 Roswell incident. If you've truly followed this field at all, you've at least seen Stanton Friedman on TV. He's basically devoted his life to research in this field, and I could not be more honored to say, Stanton Friedman, welcome to Speaking of Strange.
Gee, what a nice introduction. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, thank you. After all the interviews you've done, that's a great compliment to me as well, then. And I tell you, you have done so much work. Let's just start with the basics. If you would, just please tell us where you're originally from, how you got to where you are, and your description of what you do.
Well, I grew up in New Jersey. It wasn't my fault. I had nothing to do with it. I spent 2 years at Rutgers University there, then 3 years at the University of Chicago. Carl Sagan and I were classmates for 3 years. He never bragged about me, but I can brag about him. He can't complain now, unfortunately.
Right.
I got bachelor's and master's in physics at the University of Chicago, and spent 14 years in industry. I think I set a record for working on canceled government-sponsored advanced research and development programs at companies like General Electric, General Motors, Westinghouse Astronuclear Lab, TRW Systems, Aerojet General Nucleonics, and I worked on nuclear airplanes and fission and fusion rockets and nuclear power plants for space. Every time I got settled, they canceled the darn program.
Mm.
Gave my first lecture in 1967 after my interest started in 1958 as a young nuclear physicist for GE. I'm not that anymore.
Yeah.
It's been a while. And I got into the business of lecturing just by virtue of doing a radio program, as a matter of fact, on KDKA Pittsburgh.
Hmm.
50,000 watt clear channel station. They had a talk show called Contact, not the movie. And I had gotten to know Frank Edwards, who had a best-selling book, Flying Saucer Serious Business. And I moved to Pittsburgh to work for Westinghouse on nuclear rockets. We did test them, incidentally, and they canceled the program. But anyway, we had the joy of the test, and it worked. And I asked Frank for any leads on who might be interested in doing something. It was about time that I stood up and spoke out. And he gave me the name of the producer of the Contact show, and I called them, and it was one of these, don't call us, we'll call you. It wasn't too long before they did, but only because somebody had canceled at the last minute, and at 6:30 I got called to be on a 7 o'clock show in person, and I lived near the station, so I was able to say, yes, they'd probably called six other people first, I don't know. And somebody at work heard me at Westinghouse, a technician, and she was in a book review club, and they were reviewing Frank's book. And she wanted me to give a talk in her living room, and I'd already talked, just to the guys at work kind of thing, other professionals. And I spoke at her living room. That was my first talk, and I did that talk show many times and started doing the chicken and peas circuit and then got into the college market and the professional groups. And I want to stress that. There's a myth out there promulgated by the nasty, noisy negativists that only kooks and quacks and uneducated little old ladies in tennis shoes believe in flying saucers. That's hogwash. What got me going was the response at the Engineering Society of Detroit, for example, which was sold out 3 weeks in advance for 1,008 people for dinner and a talk, and a whole host of technical groups, chapters of the American Nuclear Society, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers. And it was their very enthusiastic response at the Engineering Society of Detroit, for example. There wasn't one negative question. And these were not little old ladies in tennis shoes. Believe me, they're hard-nosed engineers and scientists and their families, too. But so when the bottom fell out of the advanced nuclear business, as it did about 1970, I went full-time in lecturing, Turns out I'm a Leo, and I love being on the stage, and the bigger the audience, the happier I am. You can call me a ham if you want, I suppose. But the thing is that I bring to the subject an odd combination, if you will. I worked on advanced propulsion systems, fission and fusion rockets. Now, that means I can respond to the silly objection that you can't get here from there. I worked on systems that will get you here from there if you want to spend the money, and it's a lot of money. Secondly, I worked under security for 14 years, and I've been to 20 archives. So I can talk about the cosmic Watergate. I wrote classified papers. I still don't have all my own papers, for that matter. And a lot of people don't understand security. I do. I mean, you have to pay attention when you've got a clearance. Third, I've had to think about the why questions. Matter of fact, I gave a paper at a conference in Las Vegas just a month ago, the UFO why questions. Because if you present data and facts, and I cover 5 large-scale scientific studies, which fewer than 2% of the people have read, but what people really want to know, it's easy to accept data, but so, okay, so why are they coming here, and why don't they land on the White House lawn, and why isn't the government telling us what it knows, and why don't they do this, that, or the other thing? Well, because I've answered, I figure, 40,000 questions over the years, I've had to think about these things more than most people, and some people seem to like my answers. And finally, hey, I like being on the stage, as I said. So not everybody who is interested in this subject likes being on the stage, and some of them are very bright, but I'll give you a good answer tomorrow. For most of my life, and it's changing now as I get old, I've been very lucky to have a very good memory and to be able to respond quickly, and I don't feel the pressure. In other words, that's us Leos, you know?
Yeah.
So it's been a good match of my professional background as a scientist, my interest in people, my enjoyment of being on the stage, and I'm still lecturing. I've slowed down a bit. I've written about close to 90 papers now, and anybody can go to my website. They can read some for free. It's www.stantonfriedman, that's F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N, just like Milton Friedman, who just died recently, one of 2 Nobel Prize winners named Friedman. Not related, but it might be, I don't know. And the other one is Jerome Friedman, a physicist from the University of Chicago, who was there when I was there.
Well, now, why do you think that given your openness to discuss these topics with your background in classified information that they haven't, you know, killed you or something by now?
Well, I've been asked that question. How come you're still alive?
Yeah.
I like living. I think it's a combination of reasons. One, I'm very careful what I do on the security side of things. I don't solicit classified documents, for example. I don't solicit treason, you know, breaking the rules and all that stuff. I have always said that I don't want technical data out on the table because you can't tell your friends without telling your enemies. You want Osama to be able to buy this stuff on the market? Mm-hmm. If Osama's still alive, I won't guarantee that. Secondly, I may be doing exactly what they want, a rational, sensible, factual, loaded presentation that doesn't scare people. That's not my goal. I want them to think that gets people ready for whenever the government finally decides it's going to tell us what's going on. So, you know, take your choice. I mean, I'm not, as I tell a lot of people, I'm not going to live my life looking over my shoulder. I've made a number of trips to Roswell, for example, and it's a 200-mile drive, 200 miles and nothing, pretty much. And anybody wanted to take me out, I mean, my answering service is told to tell people where I am and what my schedule is and what hotel I'm staying at and what my flights are and all this kind of stuff.
Brilliant, huh?
I put my phone number in my books. I had 2 calls today from people who are reading it in the one was in Top Secret Magic, and the other was Crash at Corona, the 2 books that I'm involved with. Uh-huh. There were videos and all that other stuff that people can see on the website. But so I don't hide. I've never had an unlisted number. And, you know, there's another part of this, too. People think, oh, you must get a hard time for coming on so strong. My lectures, Flying Saucers, are real. Underline and capitalize the R and exclamation point at the end. In other words, I'm not an apologist ufologist. But I've only had 11 hecklers, and two of them were drunk, and that's in well over 700 lectures, if you include the professional groups and the colleges in 50 states, 9 provinces, and 16 other countries. So I know that it's okay. There have been no tomatoes, you know, no eggs, and the skeptics aren't really a problem. And contrary to what many people think, well, let me illustrate. At one college, and when I speak on colleges, as I often do, I sometimes do classes earlier in the day, you know, could be in physics, could be in all kinds of things. Some professors don't want to work every day.
Yeah.
But in one class, I said, I want to find out how you feel about some things, but I want you to do it with your eyes closed. You'll vote with your hand, because I don't want you to be influenced by your classmates. It turns out, to make a long story short, I was very careful in how I asked the questions, and the professor was going along with me. 80% of the kids, there were about 100 students in the class, 80% thought most people didn't believe in UFOs. And yet 80% of that group did believe in UFOs.
Mm.
So it appears that our behavior, will we report a sighting, will we laugh if somebody mentions flying saucers, etc., is determined by our perception of how other people will respond, and not by our own views.
Mm-hmm.
So I happen to be one of the shepherds rather than one of the sheep. So I get a good response partly because most people have accepted the reality, and the guys who are totally against it won't even come to my lectures.
Yeah,
they won't waste their time.
That's a great commentary on how things have changed over the years and what the current state of the public mindset is. We've got to take a break, but what a wonderful beginning to this hour. Folks, when we come back from this break, I'm going to ask Stan Friedman, who are these aliens? Where do they come from? I'm sure he's been asked that question a million times, so it'll be fascinating for us to hear his thoughts on that subject. My goodness, this hour is going to fly by quickly. Stanton Friedman is probably the world's top UFO expert, if I can say so. You can go to stantonfriedman.com. First name is S-T-A-N-T-O-N, last name F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N, and there is a link at speakingofstrange.com. And he actually also has a CD-ROM and some other materials available for you as well that we'll talk about here shortly. But I hope you check his website out, and we're going to dig into some brass tacks when we come back here on Speaking of Strange. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren. Friedman is here with us, and he is the legendary Stanton Friedman. You can find the link to his website at speakingofstrange.com. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren. And Stanton, who are these aliens, and where do they come from?
Okay, let's make clear, I do not think all UFOs are alien spacecraft.
Right.
I'm only interested in the ones that are, just like I'm only interested in the isotopes that are fissionable when I build a nuclear reactor kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The only good case that gives us a real handle on where they might come from is the Betty and Barney Hill abduction of 1961, as reported in the book by John Fuller, The Interrupted Journey, and as shown on television, the UFO incident starring James Earl Jones and Estelle Parsons. Interracial couple, very important case, and if you look on the web, there's all kinds of stories about it, but in that case, Betty saw a star map. She was a social worker, a supervisor in the welfare department, state of New Hampshire. Barney was on the governor's civil rights commission, worked for the post office. Ultra respectable people, very active in their communities. And Betty, they were abducted on board a craft. It's a long story, which I won't go into. The important thing is Betty saw, she asked the leader where he came from in the understatement of the decade. She says, I know you're not from around here. Well, that's certainly true. And he showed her what I can only call a hologram, a three-dimensional model, like of a map of the heavens, whatever. Anyway, Betty was asked by the psychiatrist who was being used to, he used regressive hypnosis to get her to relive the experience because there was a period of missing time for her and Barney, and they didn't realize that until they went over the story and, hey, how come you got home at that time, you know? Anyway, Dr. Benjamin Simon, a Boston psychiatrist, treated loads of shell shock war veterans during World War II. He wasn't a UFO buff at all, but he was very good with people who'd had traumatic experiences, shell shock war veterans, they call them, but now it's post-traumatic stress syndrome you're suffering from, you know. And so he was very good at extracting, getting people to relive difficult situations, traumatic ones. And he asked Betty to draw the map if she could remember it accurately, and she did. And a woman named Marjorie Fish built a total of 26, was the last number I had for Marjorie, three-dimensional models. Out of that, the base stars on this map turned out to be two stars, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli, in the constellation of Reticulum, which you have to go below the equator to see. Now, here's the important part. We, in our galactic neighborhood, I mean, the galaxy, the Milky Way, is big, maybe 100,000 light years across and a couple hundred billion stars. Well, saying that doesn't tell you much of use in trying to figure out where these guys are from. However, within 55 light years of here, just down the street, around the corner kind of thing, there are 1,000 stars, roughly. We keep finding new ones because our instruments get better, little small stars we find. Anyway, about 1,000 stars. Of those, 46 are similar to the sun. Not too hot, not too cold, not too old, not too new, you know, not too close to another star. All the number of characteristics here. Anyway, it turns out that of those 46, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 are the closest to each other pair of sun-like stars in our local neighborhood. Now, the next star over from the sun, Alpha Centauri, is a little over 4 light years away. But Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli, they're only 39 light years from here, but they're only an eighth of a light year apart from each other. So they are about 35 times closer to each other than the sun is to the next star over. And from a planet around either one, you can directly observe the other star all day long. That's how bright it would be in the sky. And with a reasonable size telescope, you could directly observe you can measure the characteristics of the atmosphere of the other star and see whether there's life there of some kind. And, oh, yes, another little interesting fact. Those two stars are a cool billion years older than the sun. Billion.
Wow.
Now, Friedman's law is that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. So you'd expect somebody who has a little time advantage over us to know a little bit more than we did. Now, look back 100 years, or even 50 years, and I got a shock. I was in college in Detroit and was going through this routine. You know, look how things have changed, microwaves and computers and all this kind of stuff, television and DNA and rockets. I said, you know, when I started work in industry, I was using a slide rule. And I looked around, and I didn't get any reaction to that. And I finally had sense enough to ask, any of you know what a slide rule is? Nobody. And that's only 50 years, less than 50 years in that case. You know, my wife bought a computer to keep the family pictures on, 200 gigabyte hard drive. Now, if I'd said that 30 years ago, you'd have thought I was nuts.
Yeah.
Totally nuts. So there would certainly be, at least to me anyway, a much greater incentive for developing techniques for interstellar travel when you got a neighbor only an eighth of a light year away than in our situation out here in the boondocks. So I'm not saying every one of the aliens comes from there. I think that's the center of the local neighborhood federation association, if you will. And I think, you see, I differ from some people. Some people think we're isolated here. The next star with thinking beings on it, maybe 1,000 light years away. And I say baloney. The whole neighborhood's loaded because there's so much time available.
But you're basing so much on her particular report. I mean,
well, that's the only case I know where we have a specific map. That map passes muster. There was an article I wrote, the first article. It was in Saga magazine, which doesn't exist anymore. But Terry Dickinson, editor of then of Astronomy magazine, mm-hmm. I went to him. We had met, and I suggested he do a story about Marjorie's work. So he did. Talked to a number of astronomers who are in my movie UFOs Are Real. You can see one of them, and Marjorie, too. It's listed on my website, who say how accurate her work was. So I'm not saying they all come from there, but I'm saying it's the only case where I have a great deal of confidence that the end results are right. Now, for all I know, they may have gone through an upheaval and they've colonized the neighborhood and left the old homestead behind, you know. Look what's happened here in the last 500 years. There weren't many, there were only Native Americans living here 500 years ago. Things have changed a little bit since then.
Yeah.
So that's a place to focus on. And the point is, too, I get so sick of hearing people saying intergalactic, meaning between galaxies. The next big galaxy over Andromeda is over 2 million light years away. I don't care about that.
Yeah.
You know, if I need a loaf of bread for dinner, if my wife needs a loaf of bread, I don't say, well, I'll be back next week. I got to go down to Sydney, Australia to get a loaf.
Right.
She says, hey, the supermarket's a mile and a quarter away, Stan. We need it for dinner.
Well, does time
you see what I'm saying?
Well, does time and space really matter to these aliens, though? I mean, have they transcended
that? Clear up a couple of problems there, too. At 1G acceleration, the acceleration of gravity here on the Earth, and Colonel Stapp took 43 Gs for a short time when he was on that rocket sled, his eyeballs hurt a bit after that.
Yeah.
Anyway, at just 1G acceleration, it only takes a year to get close to the speed of light. A year. Not a century. Secondly, what Einstein said, everybody comes at me, well, you're talking 39 light years, minimum transit time is 39 years, right? No. For the pilots, if you go 99.99% of the speed of light, and we in physics make particles and accelerators that go a lot faster than that, a whole bunch more nines, in other words, but at just 99.99% of the speed of light, you can go 39 light years in a touch over 6 months pilot time. You go out, come back, marry your grandchild's best friend, and, you know, it's the gift of immortality. Besides which, we don't know that they come from the home base. I once did a lecture tour, started in Central South Carolina, as a matter of fact, where I did 25 lectures in 35 days in 15 states.
Good grief.
I left home. I was younger then. And I got home after I'd gone from A to B to C to D to ED. I didn't go out, come back, et cetera. So these guys, there may be a base in the solar system on the backside of the moon, out in the asteroid belt. Mm-hmm. Remember, the English had coaling stations in the Atlantic to get from one place to another. And, you know, I'm reminded there used to be an old algebra problem. You can carry enough gasoline or enough water to last you 3 days, but the desert, it'd take you 10 days to cross. How do you do it? Well, you go out, you leave some, you come back, you go out again, leave some more the next stop, and you keep doing the last part of the trip, you wind up where you're going. In other words, one of the things that's characterized our journey into space has been being clever rather than powerful. There was a guy, an astronomer, in 1941, proved that the required initial launch weight of a chemical rocket able to get a man to the moon and back would be 1 million tons. That's a little large, even for me.
Yeah.
However, less than 30 years later, we got three guys to the moon and back, still with the dumb old chemical rocket, whose initial launch weight was 3,000 tons.
Yeah.
He made all the wrong assumptions. He assumed a single-stage rocket limited to 1G acceleration. He presumed you had to provide all the energy for the rocket. We do cosmic freeloading all the time.
Mm-hmm.
When we go to the moon, as a matter of fact, we use the moon's gravitational field to pull us in. When we come back, we take advantage of the Earth's atmosphere. We don't fire a retro rocket to slow us down. You better get the angle right, you know, when you're coming in. Remember Apollo 13?
Oh, yeah.
A tricky bit.
The old slingshot. And, we got to take another break. And I tell you, folks, what a fascinating conversation this is. And when we come back, some things I want to dig in tonight with Stanton Friedman are... what do these aliens want from us? And also some questions that were raised earlier in the show about, say, the laser scalpel, so to speak, that Corso talked about in his book. What was the power supply for that? More about atomic propulsion. My goodness, we can go in so many directions, and Stanton Friedman is the man to talk about all of these things with. You can visit his website, stantonfriedman.com. There is a link at speakingofstrange.com. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, and we'll be back right after this. Joshua P. Warren, and I could not be more thrilled to have Stanton Friedman, a man whom I've admired for a long time, and you've probably all seen him in many places for many years. He is probably the world's top UFO expert, even though it's a subjective statement. I don't think many people, at least here in the civilian market, know more than he does, and you'll find a link to his website, stantonfriedman.com, through speakingofstrange.com. Based upon what you've understood, Stanton, what do these aliens want from us?
Well, in one of my papers, I have 26 reasons for coming to planet Earth. You know, this is the honeymoon capital, this corner of the galaxy. It turns out the Earth is the densest planet in the solar system. Not the heaviest, the densest. And you say, who cares? Well, that means there are more heavy elements here, dense materials like platinum, gold, rhenium, osmium, uranium, tungsten. These are rare in the universe, we know from studying stars, but they all have special properties. And so, you know, why did people go west to California back in 1849? Gold in them, our hills.
Yeah.
So they may have been mining good stuff here for a long time. But you can think of a lot of other reasons. They're graduate students doing your thesis work on the development of a primitive society. They're broadcasters of the weekly show Idiocy in the Boondocks. And, you know, I could go on like that. But rather than do that, I make one assumption about every advanced civilization. It's concerned about its own survival and security. I think that's a fair assumption, because everybody we know certainly is.
Mm-hmm.
That being the case, you have to keep tabs on the primitives in the neighborhood, but only close enough tabs, really close tabs, on those who show signs of being able to bother you. In other words, as long as we're stuck on planet Earth with limited capabilities technologically, we can't hurt somebody out there. But at the end of World War II, and sightings have gone on for thousands of years, but certainly before World War II, but at the end of World War II, there were three signs to any smart aliens that soon these idiot earthlings, this primitive society whose major activity was obviously tribal warfare. I mean, we only killed 50 million of our own kind.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we forget about that, and destroyed 1,700 cities. There were three signs that soon these idiots would be moving out, soon meaning 100 years, which is nothing on a cosmic timescale. The three signs were nuclear weapons, and the atmosphere is loaded with particles that say, uh-oh. secondly, Secondly, we have rockets. The V-2 rockets from, you know, Germany to England weren't being used to carry the mail, you may have noticed. And third, powerful radar as a manifestation of sophisticated electronics, which were growing. You didn't see that before World War II. You put them all together, and less than 100 years, these guys are moving out. Now, isn't it amazing that the only place on the planet in July 1947 where you could study all three of these was southeastern New Mexico? First atomic bomb, Trinity site on the grounds of the White Sands Missile Range. That was 1945. Secondly, that's where we were firing all the captured German V-2s. We brought back a boatload, literally, of them. And third, that's where we had our best radar to track the rockets, which often didn't go where they were supposed to go. One went south to Mexico instead of going north in New Mexico. So I went through that litany on an English television program, and an English astronomer said, well, they could have gone to the Soviet Union. Sorry, but they didn't test their first atomic bomb until 1949, August, 2 years later. So I think they're here, if I can put one word on it, it's to keep us from leaving. What do you call it when you say, uh-oh, quarantine, I think is the word. Because I've asked a lot of people, if you were an alien, would you want Earthlings out there? And it's funny how everybody says no.
Right. Good point. Well, now, when it comes to the power supply, you know, earlier I was talking with a friend of the show, Mobius, and he is really curious about the fact that in Lieutenant Philip J. Corso's book, and I'm not sure how credible you find that resource, but he talks about something similar to a laser scalpel that was recovered, and one glaring omission is that there is no power source mentioned for this scalpel. Was it a AA battery? I mean, do you know anything about that and what power source they are using?
I do have a piece on Lieutenant Colonel Corso's book, The Day After Roswell, on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. And I think he rather vastly overstated his role. But when it comes, you've got two separate problems here, and I think it's important to divide the problem into two parts. One is, how do you get between star systems? And the other is, once you're in the vicinity of a planet with its gravitational field and its atmosphere, you know, an entirely different circumstance, what do you use then to flit around the planet? And there's a direct analogy here. Think of a huge aircraft carrier, about 1,100 feet long, and I forget, 80, 90,000 tons, and it carries maybe 75 little airplanes, and it carries the fuel for the airplanes. The aircraft carrier is nuclear-powered. As a matter of fact, doesn't need refueling for 18 years, which is a pretty neat trick. The airplanes are not yet, although we did operate jet engines on nuclear power back in the 50s. Didn't go do much with them, but that's another story. Anyway, between the stars, I like nuclear fusion. I mean, obviously, I think they really work by techniques about which we know nothing, because we're not that smart and we haven't been around that long. But I do know that every advanced civilization will know about nuclear fusion, for the simple reason that that's the power source of all the stars. The sun is a fusion factory, if you will. We didn't realize that until about 1938, incidentally. We thought it was just a mass of burning gas because we didn't know about nuclear things. But anyway, when I worked on nuclear fusion propulsion systems way back in the early 60s, would you believe, we found that if you use the right stuff in the right way and kick particles out the back end of a fusion rocket that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as you can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. So on a miles per gallon basis, boy, man, that's the way to go. Now, within the atmosphere, I think magneto aerodynamics is my best bet. That's like the electromagnetic submarine. In other words, you create a plasma, you ionize the air. That's what glows when a meteor goes by in the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Around a craft, and you interact with electric and magnetic fields, and it turns out there's a huge amount of, most of it's still classified data about this, that you can control lift, drag, heating, sonic boom production, radar profile, all those good things. And there was an electromagnetic submarine that used a different electrically conducting fluid instead of ionized air that flows seawater in nice electrically conducting fluid. And we've actually operated. I know the man who did it, Dr. Stuart Way, worked for Westinghouse and a bunch of students at University of California, Santa Barbara. Back in the 60s, mind you, they operated an electromagnetic submarine. No moving parts. And so your power supply can be a nuclear reactor, a radioisotope thermal electric generator like we use on all our deep space probes. You know, the Cassini spacecraft that's out there at Saturn. Mm-hmm. That's got plutonium-238 radioisotope thermoelectric generators that are going to last for a long, long time. Again, no moving parts, incidentally, taking advantage of some of our sacred laws of physics, which usually work. Nuclear submarines can go around the world underwater without surfacing. It's pretty neat stuff. So I think these things show us the way. If we can figure out techniques already in our technological infancy, we're much better at killing than we are at growing food for all our people and taking care of our medical problems, all the rest of that. But still, if we already can figure it out, then somebody who got a little head start on us, 1,000 years, million, billion, they're going to know a heck of a lot that we don't know. And the thing is that progress comes from doing things differently. In an unpredictable way. That laser you were talking about is not just a better light bulb. Entirely different physics. The fusion rockets and fission rockets that I worked on, and we successfully operated fission rockets on the ground, 4,400 megawatts, twice the power of Grand Coulee Dam and something less than 7 feet in diameter. And that was back in the 60s, mind you.
Yeah.
These would be upper stages, incidentally. You don't use them to get off the Earth. You assemble in orbit, just like when we go to the moon, you know. You get things ready up there, and then you take off. These aren't hopeless, is what I'm saying. We don't need to go. We need magic. I mean, I like magic, M-A-J-I-C. That's why my book is Top Secret, M-A-J-I-C, about classified documents relating to Roswell and a group called Majestic 12 set up to deal with the crash saucer at Roswell. As a matter of fact, there's a radio special on my website. Hey, Crash at Corona, the definitive study of the Roswell incident, top secret magic, all about the Majestic 12 documents, a new edition last year, as a matter of fact, and my CD-ROM, UFOs, the real story, all for the small sum of $35, including priority mail. You can get them by PayPal. The books will be autographed. And I mention it because the CD-ROM isn't available except for me. And if you get the books from me, you can get them through Amazon. But at least I autographed them, which you can't get from Amazon.
And that's a deal. And I tell you, I hope that our listeners will support the work that you are doing. And I know it's quality stuff because your name is a mark of quality. We're up on another break here. But when we come back in the final minutes, I'd like to get Stan Friedman's thoughts on whether or not aliens have interacted with us biologically, and any final thoughts that he may have to express to you. Amazing how the hour has flown by. I'm Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange. Show it has been, and Stanton Friedman is my guest. You can go to his website, stantonfriedman.com. That last name is spelled F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N, and there is a link at speakingofstrange.com. And here in the final minutes, Stanton, how do you feel about the possibility of alien intervention in human genes, say the fact that primitive humans may have somehow been injected with these alien genes to create modern humans?
Well, I leave plenty of room for that. The abduction cases seem to indicate that we're dealing with, to some extent, a hybridization program. You know, and if I said that 40 years ago, you'd have said you're out of your mind, man. But now when you look at reproductive technology with not just cloning, but inserting genes from one species into another, doing all kinds of strange things, you know, even trees that produce insecticides, you know,
yeah,
by genetic stuff. So there's one of the areas where we've certainly made a lot of progress. I mean, if I told you you could take a cigarette that somebody's been smoking and get enough stuff off of it to get the genetic pattern of that person, you know, that's pretty far out stuff, but it's right. So I think they may very well be doing this because many of the abduction cases indicate ova have been taken, sperm have been taken, there have been partial pregnancies. It sounds far out, but it's not so far out if you allow a little more extrapolation from where we are. Now, what they're doing, maybe they need to grow some kind of stuff. Maybe they're checking all our biological genetic diseases. I have a son who's a hemophiliac. Only 1 in 10,000 has that. So if you're looking around, you got to pick up an awful lot of specimens, don't you, to find one that has their whole bunch of genetic diseases. It may be that when push comes to shove, they say, look, we know how to cure a whole bunch of diseases you guys have. Here's the problem, guys. You got to straighten up and fly right.
Yeah.
I think that may be part of the picture of what's going on here. It shouldn't be surprising. It would have been if we didn't know that about DNA. I mean, I was already around for quite a while when DNA was discovered, you know. It's not yeah. like we knew about it all the time. So, yeah, I think there is a very good probability we may be somebody's colony. We may be somebody's crop. Maybe this is the devil's island of this corner of the galaxy. They dumped all the bad boys and girls here, and that's why we're so nasty to each other. Hey, Georgia and Australia were started by convicts, you know.
Yeah, good point. Okay, well, now, once again, now, what can listeners do to learn more about you and your work?
Okay, they can go to my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. They can get the radio special package, two books and a CD-ROM, $35, post office box 958, Holton, H-O-U-L-T-O-N, Maine, M-E-0-4-7-3-0-0-9-5-8, or use PayPal. They can keep their eyes open. 2007 is going to be a big year. The 60th anniversary of Roswell, I'll be there in early July. There are several books coming out. One is by a North Carolinian, Scott Ramsey, about the Aztec New Mexico crash in March of 1948. I'll be at the Aztec conference in March. Another is by Kathy Martin, Betty Hill's niece. We mentioned before about the Hill abduction case. It's called Captured, an Insider's Look at the Betty and Barney Hill Case. I was involved with that. Kathy did most of the work. There's another book called Shoot Them Down by Frank Fascino, Jr., who started very interested in what happened in Flatwoods, West Virginia in 1952. But we wound up finding out, and I worked with him on some of this, that the orders were given to military pilots in 1952. If these craft don't land when instructed to do so, shoot them down. Head of the American Rocket Society was not happy and sent a letter to the president about that. Wow. But Major General stated in print that we have scrambled jets after them hundreds of times. So that book will be out, Shoot Them Down by Frank Fascino, Jr. Scott should have a book about Aztec. Jesse Marcel, Jr., who is a medical doctor, a helicopter pilot, was a colonel in Iraq for a year, flight surgeon. He's the son of the intelligence officer at Roswell and whole Roswell stuff. He's got a book that'll be coming out at Roswell on the anniversary called Roswell, It Really Happened. He handled pieces of the wreckage. And so, you know, those are pretty good qualifications. Medical doctor, colonel, flight surgeon, served on military aircraft accident investigative teams. That's a pretty good background, I would say, for a witness.
Good stuff, Stanton Friedman. The clock has got us, but thank you so much. This has been one of the watermarks of the show, having you on here, and we'll continue to follow your progress, and I truly appreciate you taking the time to be my guest tonight.